This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers and readers. I'm Vaughn.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, troubled, dead or missing in action, the parent-child dynamic in speculative fiction.
I love the beginning of that one, because it's just troubled, dead or missing in action.
Yeah,
it just sounds like an average Wednesday.
Are you troubled, dead or missing in action? Making new trouble be gone. After 1 week, you'll see noticeable improvement. Don't ask me what trouble be gone is. I don't know. Maybe something like a hemorrhoid cream.
Yeah. Oh my god.
I don't know.
This is made all the fun the fact that we've also been talking about the whole going back in time to kill yourself over chocolate cake, which adds a whole new context to the troubled, missing, dead action. Have you been eating chocolate cake? Wow, we got the weird explanation for you. Anyway, back to the topic at hand. We are actually talking about the anomaly of basically disappearing parents off, particularly in sort of children and YA fiction, and sort of why that is.
Yeah, obviously we're not just talking about young adult children, we're talking about science fiction and fantasy in general as well. And it's not just about missing parents, it's also about how they're represented generally, because there is kind of a big issue here. Most other genres have managed to redress the balance of the child-parent dynamic, and that includes the adult-child, the grown-up child-parent dynamic.
Yeah.
Quite well, and show both healthy and not so healthy and flawed and nuanced relationships. Not so science fiction and fantasy. It seems to be a real stumbling block for us. And what started me off down this route is I've been watching the BBC series of His Dark Materials, which, whatever else you may think of it, Ruth Wilson is doing an incredible job of portraying Mrs. Coulter. I'm going to assume that you've read the His Dark Materials trilogy, guys, because this might be a tiny bit spoilery in terms of plot, but I'll try not to spoil anything that's kind of on screen. But what's so interesting about her portrayal of Mrs. Coulter is that it's very nuanced. This is someone who, let's just say that cats are generally better parents. Both canonically in the books, and actually it's kind of offensive to cats, but also on screen, this is someone who has some serious deep issues there, and I'll go into that a little bit more later, and what kind of effect that has on the abandoned child. I mean, in all fairness, Lord Asriel's a terrible father. He just leaves Lyra at Jordan College. And yes, okay, he thinks he's protecting her. And in a sense, he's getting her away from a potentially very abusive mother. But he leaves her without any parents at all. And he lies about who she is to her and to and makes everyone else complicit in that lie. And while I understand, obviously, there are things that parents don't tell children because there are truths we're not ready for at a certain stage in our lives. And that sucks. But some of that is a genuine concern. And there's never going to be a good time. But there's better times than sort of dumping it on someone the minute they're born, for example.
Yes.
It just means that there's a massive world adjustment. And part of growing up, obviously, part of becoming from child to adult is this massive world adjustment. That, part of that is understanding that your parents aren't God, which is difficult for Lyra because her parents have never been around. So for her, it's two people she admired turn out to be very, very fallible. And not only fallible, but they turn out to actually be her parents. So that's a real head spinner.
Yeah.
And I find that entire dynamic really fascinating. So that's where this one has come from. And we're going to sort of look at it in general in fiction. And there's quite a lot to unpack here as well. One of the biggest things is that parents in fiction suffer from not being allowed to be complete people, I think is probably the theory I'm going with.
Yeah. And I would tend to agree with you. And I wonder, a part of me believes that this is because a lot of other genres are very, very focused on interpersonal relationships. Sorry, is it interpersonal relationships? Is that
that's right.
Term?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which are part of creating drama. You certainly need that in genres like, you know, crime, where people are at the center. Basically, any genre where people are at the center really does need to kind of examine what makes people people. And a big part of what makes us who we are is our relationship with our parents and with our family. So they're kind of more crucial elements, whereas the doesn't actually tend to historically focus on those interpersonal relationships that much. It does tend to sort of focus now a lot more on kind of romantic relationships, but up until this point, it's kind of had more of an external focus, looking at either, and the same with sci-fi, looking at wider questions of, you know, collective humanity and morality and things like that, and it tends to focus on that. So I think that that's why fantasy and sci-fi have been sort of left behind a little bit when it comes to the way that parents have been presented.
Yeah, I think there's definitely something to that. It is a huge anomaly, though, if you think about it, because certainly if you start off with a young character in science fiction or fantasy, then one of the biggest formative relationships, even if it's an absent relationship or relationship that never actually takes place, it's still massively formative. Yeah. It's the relationship you have with the people who effectively created you. And okay, in science fiction, then that can also pertain to someone who literally created you out of bits and pieces.
Looking at you, Frankenstein.
I was more thinking robots, but yeah, basically. Data, for example.
And Data.
We are naturally wired as humans to want to, I suppose, put our parents on a pedestal, at least for a tiny proportion of our lives. And as I've said, part of growing up is discovering that your parents actually aren't God and are very fallible. And it's just a massive hole in the middle of SFF in general that this is not something that's really discussed.
Right. And also, I think that when it is brought up, it's brought up in actually quite a simplistic way, which is that, you know, we've talked about the fact that the parents aren't allowed to be full people. They're not allowed to be kind of, they're just sort of there. They're kind of like a prop in the background. And that counts even if the parent themselves is an important figure in his life. So, for instance, the absent, you know, the absent mother who, you know, the main character might be trying to discover, find out about, or, you know, or think about very often, acts only as this kind of balm during certain situations, and is always kind and good and correct. And they're not actually a fleshed out person. They're an ideal.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the thing that gets me is that very often in situations where there has been some form of child abandonment, either on purpose or reluctantly, or, you know, someone has died, you don't very often get that resentment coming through. And it seems to be that people kind of fail to engage with the idea that you can desperately love someone and just desperately want to see them and still be angry and resentful for their abandonment or for their treatment of you. It's okay, and it's very normal to balance those two things out. And very often we just don't get that at all. It's either one or the other, and it's not actually a realistic view of another human being and this very complicated relationship, which is active even if one of the characters themselves are absent.
Definitely. And I think this sort of feeds into the whole, this seems to be kind of mostly a Western thing in general, certainly in fiction, but then I could be wrong, perhaps it's more widespread, but you notice it because it's more Western science fiction fantasy. And that is that no one seems to want to address the fact that your relationship with your parents is as nuanced as any relationship with anybody else.
Yeah. So
when you're writing fiction, your character's relationship or non-relationship with their parents will be as nuanced. They won't just be, but I can always go back to dear old mum or dear old dad or whatever. They've always got my back, or they were always an asshole kind of thing. It's far more nuanced than that. In the same way that a lot of emphasis is put on the romantic partner or the absolute enemy or whatever, or even the best friend, but not as much as on the parents. And I think that is because no one really wants to address the fact that most parents aren't good or bad. They're just flawed people, and quite often they do damage just by being flawed people. And then some parents are actively abusive. Some parents are non-actively abusive, as in they don't even realise they're being abusive. They've kind of never mended themselves enough to be anything better. And some of them really love their children but cannot be around them for some reason. And some of them just don't love their children. And that's the big fundamental one. People do not want to hear that some parents just don't love their children. And I think that's a real issue. And it's not necessarily science fiction fantasy's job to completely redress that issue, but it looks weird when nobody touches it at all.
Yeah. I think you're right. And I also think that it's very important to remember that lots of people have very, very different relationships with their parents. And for the relationships that we do tend to see in sci-fi and fantasy, they tend to be quite the samey. You know what I mean? They tend to be quite samey or the same. One or the other, Madeline. Don't merge them. But every now and again, you do kind of get some really versions of very interesting relationships with parents in sci-fi and fantasy. And I think the reason that they stand out is because they are a little bit peculiar in so much that we don't actually see it very often.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, before we talk about the difference between the way mothers and fathers are portrayed in speculative fiction, I will just briefly mention an interview I saw with Tamora Pierce, and this was years ago, actually. This is how long I've been following this author, since I was quite a young teenager. But she was saying in that interview, and it was before her Protector of the Small Quartet came out, and someone made the point of saying, Caladri's mother and Caladri have a really good relationship. It's a really healthy relationship. How do you feel about having written this mother-daughter dynamic that's really healthy? And Tamora Pierce said, well, yeah, she said, to start with my original books, and she'd written something like 12 before this, even more than that, probably more like 15. Mm-hmm. She'd written 15 books before this, and none of them portrayed a good mother-daughter relationship because she herself had difficulty communicating one, because she didn't really have a good relationship with her own mother. And it wasn't that it was abusive or anything like that. It was just that they didn't really get each other. They didn't have a good relationship, and it was always strained. And therefore, what she knew didn't come out in her books, so she had to make an actual effort. And I remember her saying, it's not easy for me to write a good mother-daughter relationship, but I wanted there to be representation that they are out there. You know, not all my characters come from situations where their families are negligent of them or don't care or don't pay attention to them. Some of them do come from families that are supportive.
Yeah. That's really interesting. I do think that it's sort of a little bit inevitable that we will project our own familial relationships into our writing.
Definitely.
And whether we're projecting them in the case of this is what my familial relationship is like, or this is what I want my familial relationship to be like, or this is the complete opposite of my familial relationship, which I'm writing about because my character craves what I have, you know, it is going to be reflected in some way or another. I think it's, you just can't kind of step away from something which has such a significant impact on you as a person.
Definitely. And I think the thing is that after a while, you kind of need to question why you keep writing certain things the same way. And I think that's what Tamora Pierce is doing. And I can completely get that. That made me think, how do I write things? You know, there's various other bits and pieces. And obviously, you'll always include things that you don't realise you're even including. Because they're so much a part of your worldview, you don't even see them. But yeah, there's definitely an argument there for, am I always writing the father as the distant patrician figure? Or am I always writing the mother as, you know, dead before the story starts?
Guilty!
Which brings us on to how our mothers and fathers treated differently in speculative fiction. And it is largely that you can have a good father who really, really bonds with his son, and maybe they go to war together or something. Or you can have a very distant patrician father who, if not actively abusive, it definitely pushes their son's development or character, or daughter's development, that she sort of becomes something to spite him. Whereas the mothers nearly always are either weak or dead.
And,
you know, they don't get to be on page and decent, but still a rounded character. So, And I think that's why I've always liked Mrs. Coulter from the His Dark Materials, even though she's an awful person. She goes through the entire trilogy and she changes, but she changes to varying shades of awful all the way through. She sees nothing wrong with taking, abducting children and basically torturing them, as long as it's not her child. For her child, she would do anything. You know, she would stand up and defy God. And it's like her one redeeming feature is the fact that somehow she manages to fall in love with her own daughter. And it's just fascinating watching the entire thing happen. And they seem to be taking it in quite an interesting direction in the series, in the sense of, yes, she's flawed, she's awful, she's doing these terrible things. But this is also a woman who is carving her way in what is a very patriarchal society. And it is a patriarchal society in His Dark Materials. It's not there as a commentary, and it's not there as a criticism or anything like that. It's just that is how those books are written, and you can draw your own judgment from it. And it stands in stark contrast to Will's world later on in the series. But in the TV series, they're kind of saying, well, this is the world, and this is the sort of people it's creating. And I think that's a really interesting perspective to take, because obviously they've got a broad lens. They're not just going from Lyra's perspective all the way through.
Yeah. Which I think is a very good idea. I haven't actually watched any of the TV series, so I can't comment on it.
I mean, I think, without going off on too much of a tangent, people are saying they're finding it too slow paced. They're not finding it as enchanting as the books. They don't like some of the little changes. I think it's one that it's worth giving it time to get going, because the intelligent choices they're making about the characters are kind of working for me. But we'll see. we'll see how it goes. So, moving on, as we said, mothers and fathers are treated very, very differently. Mother-daughter relationships versus father-son relationships versus father-daughter relationships versus mother-son relationships, they're again also treated very, very differently. And of those four potential, I mean, I'm sorry, I'm not talking about non-binary, etc., but if we just talk very basically, and then we'll fit in around it if we can. Basically, the rarest of these particular pairings out of the four potential ones is the mother-daughter relationship in being terms of being portrayed at all in science fiction and fantasy. And in fact, you know, I've got a little list of things that sort of happen here. So I'm going to say what's on my list, and you can tell me whether you've noticed the same thing, if that works for you.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. Right, so basically, mothers rarely appear in fantasy, let alone are allowed to be people. If they appear, they're basically really engaged in furthering the interests of their male offspring, whether they have female offspring or not.
Yeah.
And if they're, you know, if they're not there, then they've been killed off really early on, and they're either this sort of paragon of virtue, or they had some sort of troubled, twisted past and completely rejected their child. They're not allowed to be in between. They're one or the other.
Yeah.
So for example, if we're looking at mothers who are really invested in their male offspring, let's take Catelyn Stark, shall we? I like her. She's quite a good character. But it really bugs me how, you know, she kind of sits by Bran's bedside when he's ill, and she follows Rob's army into war, and she kind of farms out her girls for someone else to look after. I mean, she kind of periodically says she's worried about Arya and Sansa, but doesn't really do anything for them. Her focus is very much on the sons. And okay, maybe that's supposed to be representative of the medieval-esque landscape that George R. R. Martin has created. But it's really bloody annoying as well.
See, I never noticed that, but now that you mention it, it's making me reanalyze everything.
I think the thing is, until I really thought about it, I hadn't noticed it and realized what was bugging me, and it was, I was trying to pin down what was bugging me. And once I did, I'm now thinking, is this kind of an internalized misogyny thing? Because basically, within the genre, within science fiction and fantasy, we are assuming that men are where the story is. Therefore, we follow mothers if the mothers are following their male offspring.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think you're right, actually. And I also think that you often get it, even if the female, the mother isn't there, that there are quite a few, you know, stories where the relationship between the son and the mother is really the thing that stands out. And I think it's also particularly, you often get the situation where the father is a despicable figure. And okay, so actually, I'm just going to point this out, that almost always, whenever there's any kind of sort of domestic or, you know, an abusive background, the father is almost always the abuser.
Yeah.
And the mother may be an enabler, as in she may not be protecting the child, but frequently, I think, particularly in fantasy, you get a situation where the mother might have run away with her child and maybe child somewhere else and then left to protect them. At which point, you know, the mother is sacrificing everything. She's that, it's not, she's not the sacrificial virgin, as it were, but she's, you know, she's very sacrificial for the sake of her child. And she throws away her life for the sake of the child. And she's this paragon of goodness. And it particularly happens, and I think actually maybe the reason it happens a lot is that you get kind of a lot of stories in mythology where the woman, a mother has basically had to run away, raise her child in secret, and then her son returns to reclaim his throne or his position or something along those lines. It happens in Greek mythology, it happens in Irish mythology. It's all over the place, really.
Yeah, see, I see those, and a lot of those myths also leave the daughters behind.
Yes.
And they don't make a point of...
Yeah.
Even people, when they're studying them, don't make a point of saying it. And to me, what that says is the mother is not necessarily doing something self-sacrificing. She's picking the child with the who will give her the most political power later on.
Yeah.
Which is a little troubling.
Yes, it is.
But you're right, it is drawing on a vast swathe of a body of lore, if you like. Something that also does this, obviously, when you do have a mother-daughter relationship... It's rarely positive. It's rarely a positive relationship, as Tamora Pierce herself said in her own work. And I think this draws quite strongly on fairy tales.
Yes. Interestingly enough, it is always the mother. It is. It's the stepmother. That's the thing that gets me, is that obviously in a lot of original fairy tales, it was the mother. And then kind of, the, you know...
Like, a lot of the... It's not natural.
We can't have that. It isn't natural. It's just, no. So it must be an unnatural woman who's kind of come in. So she must be the stepmother instead, who's rejecting these children because they're not actually hers. Kind of like a a cuckoo that's coming in and shoving out the eggs that are there to just so that they can lay their own.
Basically,
you do always get these kind of very, very sort of negative relationships, particularly with stepmothers, but with mothers and daughters. But yeah, even if it's a stepmother, that's the other thing. This is the bit that really annoys me, because step parents are always depicted as these kind of really negative figures. Particularly stepmothers, they're seen as sort of evil, like they're coming in on a territory. And I very, very rarely, if ever, see examples of this in sci-fi or fantasy, where the child actually, the child, they're not necessarily children, but the offspring, has a good relationship with their step-parent, who might actually love their step-parent more than, their birth mother, because their birth mother abandoned them or was abusive or anything like that, or who might actually just love them all equally. We just very, very rarely get that at all, when actually in reality lots and lots and lots of people have step parents, as well as, you know, birth parents as well, and adoptive parents, and there's love and hate going all the way around. It's really, really complicated, and there's lots of options, but we just don't see those in sci-fi
and
fantasy.
Yeah, I mean, that's the issue, isn't it? It's just so, it's not nuanced. It can only be one thing. And
yeah,
admittedly, if it's just going to be a tiny bit of a character's backstory, you can understand why people don't want to go into it, but really you don't need very many words. You know, the odd line here and there actually paints quite a good picture and a nuanced portrait, if you want it to.
Yeah.
So it's a case of questioning yourself after you've done your first draft, or even before you start your first draft, and saying, well, does this have to be a wicked stepmother type character? Am I drawing on that archetype? Is it unfair? Perhaps they could have a good relationship. It's the same as saying, perhaps I'm not going to use a gendered slur here, for example. Or is it appropriate to?
Yeah.
It's not saying that anything's wrong or anything's right, but it's saying, ask yourself questions at each of those steps. Am I just feeding into the same mythology and perpetuating it? Because as we've said before, and we will keep saying on Dissecting Dragons till we're blue in the face, art reflects reality, and then reality starts to reflect art. So the two...
Yeah.
The two are like a causal loop, okay? There's no point of origin, ultimately.
Yeah.
And they will keep perpetuating each other. So if you want things to change, you need to start changing art.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, looking at some of the tropes, these can be largely applied to mothers, but I think they can also be applied to fathers and things as well.
Yeah.
So you've got, let's take the first one, the weak parent, the weak mother. For whatever reason, they leave a vacuum for the main character to fill.
Yes.
So, just trying to think
of an example.
A particular example, yeah.
Well, I mean, I've got one, but I'm not sure you'll like it.
Yeah, go for it.
A Court of Thorns and Roses.
Okay.
At the beginning. The father of the three sisters is basically, he's a weak character. He's kind of given up. He's sort of allowing the light that, you know, that he's been dealt a hand, and he's basically just accepted it, despite the fact that it's basically putting his children in dire straits.
Yeah, having failed instead of trying again, he's decided to just roll into the failure and let everyone fend for themselves.
Yeah. And it, for me, actually, it's quite interesting, because it really, you get this big sort of consequence of how each of the characters therefore respond to this. So Feyre basically steps up, because she has decided, right, I'm not just going to let us die. I've got to kind of step up and do this in order for us to survive. Whereas the older sister, Nesta, is really, really unpleasant to both Feyre and to the father, because actually she's angry at the father. She's angry at the father for just rolling over and giving up. And she's willing to starve to try and provoke her father to sort of get off his ass, as it were, to kind of take action and not to just give up. And she's annoyed at the fact that Feyre is basically allowing their father to get away with what he's doing and is taking on the responsibility instead. And for me, that it really was a very interesting father, you know, daughter's relationship, because they all love each other as a family, but there's a lot of strain and issues there between all of them, all because of this father's decision.
And I think
and he really obviously cares for them, but yeah.
Yeah, that's something that encapsulates it really interestingly. As you say, they all love each other, but they don't really like each other a lot of the time, and they don't necessarily understand each other. And that is a quintessential thing about being part of a family. You can all really love each other,
yes,
but you might not understand each other, and sometimes you're really not going to like each other. Just because you all share, genetic material, or even not, maybe you're part of an adopted family or whatever, you might not still all like each other all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, let's try the... this is an interesting one. A child abandoned in order for the parent to follow a higher purpose or to serve their own ambition. That's a twisty one, really. That's thinking of things like Dune, the Bene Gesserit, where they were ordered to only have daughters, not sons, because they weren't ready for the Kwisatz Haderach yet. But while they teach their children and look after them, when asked to do so, they are expected to give their children up and give them to the Order, for example, or to see them off into marriages.
Yeah.
Most of their children are brought up not knowing which member of the Bene Gesserit is actually their mother, for example. So they don't know. They're brought up in this sense of not really understanding where they've come from, despite having this strong order around them. And again, this is kind of Lyra. Lord Asriel wants to chase after dust, you know, particles of dust. He wants to find ways into new worlds. So he leaves his daughter, who he doesn't really value as he should, because she's now a symbol of the relationship that went supernova, a relationship he was having with a married woman. And Mrs. Coulter doesn't go and collect Lyra initially because she can't, she doesn't have the power to. But also in the book it says that she just was so proud and scornful of the entire thing, sort of, again, her reputation being in tatters, and Lord Asriel basically just leaving her because there was a big fight, basically. And she sort of turns her back on her daughter, and she dedicates everything towards the General Oblation Board and to furthering her aims in conjunction with scientific theory around the church. And it's just, you know, to both of the parents, it's like, it's a heart, you know, a child would get in the way. The sort of demands a child puts on your time would get in the way of us pursuing our higher purpose. And they both believe equally that their purpose is important and higher.
Yeah.
They don't, neither of them have got any illusions that their purpose is good. In fact, good doesn't come into it at all. And yet, at the same time, that you get to the end of the third book, and both of them say, I mean, Lord Asriel even says, it's something to have brought a daughter like Lyra into the world. Despite everything both of them have accomplished and lost and what have you, despite the fact that they're literally both about to die together, he's like, you know, the one good thing we kind of did together was we created Lyra, you know, without them saying, yeah, we both abandoned her as well. So that's not to say that you don't get to be a full person once you have a child. Absolutely you do, but I think you ought to know what you're giving up before you move on. At least that's how it comes across in the books.
Absolutely.
Purpose is an interesting one, because that's one with the potential for so much nuance, and it's horrible but also kind of fascinating. I don't think I've ever seen a positive portrayal of that.
No, and I'm not sure I have either, actually. I'm trying to think.
I mean, that is a hard one to sell, isn't it? You know, I have this child, but, you know, I've abandoned them or given them up or sold them down the river because my gods told me to, even if my gods were science and money and prestige. It's that's a hard sell.
Yeah, certainly not one where it's been accepted. Yes. Weirdly enough, and I don't really kind of want to talk about this too much at all, but some of these things are, I've sort of explored a little bit in the Hamartia cycle for this exact purpose, because I wanted to kind of actually look at familial relationships within the Hamartia cycle rather than actually romantic relationships. There is romance, of course, as well, but I was more interested in the familial and friendship relationships. And the first thing I did was give Rufus a very, very loving stepmother.
Yeah.
Whom he has an excellent relationship with. And then there is the case that basically Rufus's birth mother did give him up. She wanted him, but not as much as basically she knew she had to fulfill her upcoming destiny, basically, yeah. Which was to, and I don't want to give away spoiler, I mean, to be honest, pretty much everyone knows what's happening at this point, but you know, she had an obligation to do, and so she had to give Rufus up, and Rufus is pretty, you know, cold toward her before he knows really what happened and why he was given up. And then he has an incredibly interesting relationship with her because he only discovers who she is, who his mother really was and why she gave him up after she's died.
Yeah.
And I literally just did that because I was like, you know what? I'm going to mix things around a little bit. Well, and have it that parents can sometimes just not be very good. Rufus's father also lies to him a lot, but they're incredibly close. But they, you know, they do have a very difficult relationship when the truth does come out.
Yeah, and it's something that comes across. It never feels one note, I don't think. And it's never a case of, well, this happened for reasons. It's there because this is a rich part of the character's backstory and what makes them the character. That I think that's the thing that escapes a lot of people who write fantasy and science fiction, is the fact that mentioning the parent relationship, or the lack of it, shapes what that character is going to become, whether they know it or not. I mean, even if we look at things like Prince of Thorns, which is grimdark, by Mark Lawrence, and Jorg Ankrath is an absolute bastard. I mean, he's an interesting bastard all the way through the trilogy. And he definitely goes on an interesting character journey and becomes less, less single-minded, less self-involved. But he's now, his mother, Mark Lawrence has done the thing where he has killed off the mother. But I don't feel that it's kind of just a convenience thing. He doesn't make her a saint. She isn't canonized after her death. You never get Jorg saying, oh, well, I think she would have been a wonderful person. Perhaps I'd have been different. You kind of get Jorg saying, yeah, well, she fucking died and left me. And I'm kind of pissed about that because she left me with a man who is an absolute monster. And his father very much is. He was an abusive asshole. So it is interesting, and it's not, once again, one note, and it does feed a little into sort of who he becomes.
Yeah.
Okay, another trope. This is kind of a cheat trope, I think. It's the unplanned separation. So let's say the child was kidnapped at birth and raised amongst strangers, didn't really know who she was. So if you think of things like She-Ra, whereby Adora was kidnapped from King Randor and what was the queen's name? My God, that's terrible. But the queen was from Earth, I remember that. Taken from Eternia to Etheria and was raised as Zordrak's sort of adopted daughter. And obviously she knew she was adopted, but didn't really know anything about her actual parents or who she was.
Yeah.
And it sort of neatly sidesteps the issue of having to have a parent abandon their child. And it also neatly sidesteps the issue of having to have a well-adjusted child-parent relationship. So I can see why people do it, but I do still think it's a bit of a cheat.
Yeah. Another good example of it is Disney's Tangled.
Yes.
Which I think does it really well, because actually they explore this very abusive relationship between the mother and daughter, which is, and it is, it's an abusive, it's an emotionally abusive relationship, which I think is depicted very, very well. Where, of course, Mother Gothel kidnapped Rapunzel so that she could have Rapunzel's power. And she, I think she even likes Rapunzel to a certain degree, but it has, doesn't love her. She loves the power. She doesn't love her as a person, doesn't value her above the power that she possesses. And of course, the whole way throughout is this symbol that occurs that shows that the king and the queen have not forgotten their daughter. And still very much love their daughter, and they want their daughter to be returned. And that plays the whole way throughout as a, you know, a juxtaposition to Mother Gothel, who is present in her life, but is not obviously a good influence.
Yeah, it's quite poignant, isn't it? The idea of the lanterns, because that, without being too heavy, being that it's a Disney film, it kind of taps into all parents who have lost a child and don't know what's happened to him or her.
Yeah, absolutely.
Everyone who's had a child abducted and never got an answer.
Yeah. Another example, which is actually a little bit more humorous, of very interesting relationships between mothers and daughters, and, you know, kind of accidentally losing a child, as it were, but actually the other way around, is from Disenchanted.
Yep.
Where obviously you have, was it Dagra? What's her name?
I honestly can't remember her name. We're not doing very well with names today, but I know who you mean.
No, we are. Not the stepmother. Oh no, is it the stepmother? God, I don't know. Because you have the stepmother, Una. Una is the stepmother.
That's right.
And then you have Tia Beanie's actual birth mother. It's been revealed, and so this is spoilers, guys, for anyone who hasn't watched the most recent episodes of Disenchanted. But basically, it's been revealed that she wanted Tia Beanie, and she wanted to get rid of her husband. And she wanted Tia Beanie for potentially malicious reasons, but she did actually want her daughter. She accidentally turned herself to stone when trying to turn her husband.
As you do.
As you do. And when she is sort of brought back, she immediately kidnaps her daughter. And even though it's not the same, it's this interesting thing, because Tia Beanie has been raised on a lie. And then there's these revelations and these massive flips about the reality of who a parent is. And I actually quite like it, because you obviously get this reality that actually her stepmother is a much better mother figure than her actual mother, who was sort of canonized and made into a saint when she was very much a villain.
Yeah, definitely. Final sort of main trope, the alternative parent. This is something that is very particularly a mother-daughter thing, I think, and that is that you can have a daughter character forming a good relationship with an older woman, a mother figure, as long as it's not her actual mother. And that's kind of a weird...
Mm-hmm.
A weird sort of recurring thing, you know. It can be like a mentor or a trainer of weaponry or something, or some, if assuming they were in sort of some sort of sci-fi army type situation, someone who's gone before, or an aunt, but it can't actually be her actual mother.
No.
And I don't know if that is partly the whole thing whereby no, very few mothers, I would think, would allow somebody to, I don't know, face down the Witch King of Angmar, for example. You know? So, It's not, I'm going to go and cut this head off this big dragon. It's like, I don't think you are. apparently, yes. You don't have that familial relationship. Apparently, an aunt would be like, yeah, that's fine. And I'm now thinking of my 3.5-year-old niece wielding a sword saying, I'm going to go and kill this demon. I'm like, no, you're not. So it doesn't hold water. I'd be like, no, I'll take care of that for you. Maybe you can get the next one in sort of, I don't know, 20 years' time. When I've got, you have to use a sword, probably.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. In that basically, they want that relationship, but they also want the distance that not being bound by blood apparently creates.
Yeah.
I think.
Now, what was that? I'm just trying to think. But it's very different when it's a mother-son relationship. So if you think of Sarah Connor and her son John Connor fated to be this great future dystopian leader, and the fact that instead of being all sort of like, no, I'm going to prevent you taking part in your own destiny, your own story, instead she trains him. So why don't we have mothers training daughters in the same way? It just seems...
Yeah.
Although I will say that recently I have once again been reading more books in Shauna Maguire's Encrypted series, and this is a huge family of cryptozoologists / monster hunters, and the children, I wouldn't say they have a great upbringing in a lot of ways, because they're not allowed to do normal child things. Everything turns into a sort of training drill for their future, but the mothers are very definitely training their daughters how to handle weapons and fight and identify cryptids, so they kind of are still giving them everything they need for their own futures.
Yeah. I think actually, weirdly enough, it does make me think of an example from a TV series where they have something like that, and that's in Teen Wolf.
Yeah.
The first few series, you have Allison, who's part of the Argent family, who are werewolf hunters.
Yeah.
And it's revealed that basically within the family, the men are the soldiers. Well, I mean, they're all soldiers, but the men are the soldiers and the women are the ones who lead.
Yeah.
And Allison's mother, this character's mother, is a kind of a huge force in wanting to, it's decided that her daughter is going to be trained, really, really sort of pushing that. And also very much interfering with kind of what's happening in terms of like even sort of getting herself killed by torturing werewolves and doing some pretty despicable sort of things. And she's this real force for nature who clearly loves her daughter, but is actually quite a dark and domineering force as well, and very much pushing towards training her daughter up to be the same kind of leader that she is.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed it. It was actually very nicely done, because it was a very nuanced relationship that was not always a good relationship, but was still one where the pair loved each other ultimately.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, there's one other sort of, coming up to towards the end of our episode, but I think I just want, there's one other example I want to talk about, and then I think we should talk a little bit about our mothers in our own work briefly before we go. Anyway, this one sort of stayed with me because I think recently I read Holly Black's The Darkest Part of the Forest, which is a standalone fairy book between several of her fairy trilogies. And when Holly Black writes fairies, expect blood, okay, because her fairies are not nice guys.
Hooray!
What's really interesting is there's a pair of twins in this, Hazel and Ben. And Hazel has always wanted to be a knight. And they live in this weird sort of village that has always known about the presence of the fair folk.
Mm-hmm.
They are aware. And it's even kind of a tourist attraction for people to come to this place where there allegedly are fairies nearby. Thing is, there really are fairies nearby. And the agreement with the locals is that the fairies will only abduct, torture and kill the tourists rather than the actual people from the village. So that's already pretty dark.
Great.
But hey, there's something sort of... Hazel and Ben's parents are very artistic. And they have the children fairly young. When I say fairly young, I mean sort of 23, 24, which, you know, is not that young for having children. But by today's standards is pretty young.
Yeah.
And they're crap parents. They haven't grown up enough in order to have twin children yet. And there are times when Hazel and Ben growing up are left dirty or left without clean clothes or left in the house all alone all day with no food or no heat because no one's remembered to pay the electricity bill. So they're kind of left in the dark a lot. And the children supplement this for each other by sort of taking care of each other. And they make friends with local children and things. And Hazel finds a book on foraging for, like, you know, 50 cents at a local library sale. And then they start foraging for food in the forest and things like that. But all the way through, it's kind of like you never feel the parents are being abusive. And yet, thinking about it, it very much is abuse. And eventually, mm-hmm. parents do grow up and start becoming proper parent figures, etc.
Yeah.
But they start doing that once the children have already turned sort of 11, 12, and it's almost too late.
Yeah.
And I would say that Hazel and Ben sort of turn out okay and everything, but their early years are years of hunger and being left in a dark, cold house by themselves while their parents go off to parties and stay up all night painting or creating music or whatever and living the artistic bohemian lifestyle and saying that they don't want their children raised in an ordinary way because they'd turn into ordinary people. So they try and normalise it for their children,
yeah.
even though what you should be able to expect as a child, the basics are that your parents care about you, they feed you, and they help you keep clean, and, you know, they send
and
you
off
to get some sort of education. So it's this idea of neglect is quite a passive form of abuse, but it is still a form of abuse.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, you're entirely right, and it's not... I think the thing is that actually, particularly in sci-fi, if there is any form of abuse, it tends to be it tends to be physical abuse, which is used.
Yeah.
And we don't very often see those other kinds of abuse, which was why I think Tangled was so popular, because it showed, emotional abuse. And, you know, similarly, abandonment, which is that you can love someone very much and still not be good for them, or still, you know, not actually be being a good parent. Loving someone is not enough to, you know, to be responsible for them.
Yeah, definitely. And when we get into the story in the darkest part of the forest, the pair of twins are 17 and... I think there's a point where the mother comes close to saying, are you trying to say you're like you are now because of, you know, the fact that we perhaps weren't the best parents? So she's woken up to the fact that actually they probably should have treated their children better, even though they weren't actively abusive. They were being, you know, non-active. And Hazel's kind of like, well, we are what we are. And there's no point really thinking about any difference. And she's not really angry or anything. She's just kind of, I don't really see the point in hashing this. And I'm not going to make you feel better by saying it's okay. I'm just going to say, we're all right where we are now. And it's up to me whether I want to go back and examine that. And I don't right now. And I think that is a very common thing for children or grown children who have just been neglected, is to say, well, I got through it. I don't really want to go back and rehash it. Or not until I'm ready to. And I'm certainly not going to do it just to make you feel better about how you treated me.
Yeah.
And same with...
Absolutely.
And the same with Tangled, with the emotional abuse. It's a kind of a, okay, I've had to unpick all of this by myself and maybe I don't want to go back and confront you with it because that's not healthy for me. So, so there obviously are some good examples of parents being flawed people. Or, you know, actively.
Yeah. Or just being people.
Yeah. But we could probably just do with a few more of them. Okay, let's very briefly talk about mothers in our own work. I know you talked a little bit about... It's Nora, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Nora in The Sons of Thestian. And obviously there's Eliane, Jonathan and Joshua as well. Particularly, you know, Joshua is brought up without either of his parents, but obviously has a father-son relationship with Rufus, which is, and I did this on purpose, which is meant to reflect the fact that you have the, and sorry, this is spoilers, but you've got brothers, Rufus and Joshua, who have a father-son relationship. Father-son, Daniel and Zachary, who have a brotherly relationship.
Yeah.
Because it all went wrong.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting twist on things, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I wanted to do it, because I did want to sort of play around with those familial relationships. But I think inevitably and very predictably, I looked back over pretty much all of my stories and went, wow, I am killing the mother a lot. I wonder why that might be. Do I have, might there be something personal about this? So I suddenly had to take a step back and go, maybe I should keep the mother in some places.
Maybe I have to get all mothers everywhere kind of thing.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, having said, in speculative fiction that the mother is nearly always like killed off before the beginning of the story, obviously that's something I've done myself. However, I will make a small plea on my behalf, and that is the fact that she's not this ineffable quality who's idealized. She is in fact someone that the main character and the main character's sisters have had a really strong relationship with, and the entire family is straining under the weight of this absence. So the very fact that she's absent means she's serving the plot probably a lot more than she could have done alive. And that's a good reason for actually killing off a character. And it's not a case of, oh, I wish Mum was here all the way through. It's a case of, I wish Mum was here. I really hate her for leaving me. I don't understand what's going on. Em spends most of the first book furious with her. And gets over it towards the end of the first book. But she's still really missing her and occasionally angry with the entire situation. And again, in the second book, you kind of get that anger at a parent trying to fix a previous negligence. So suddenly Em's dad is like, I've been really absent, I'm trying to make up for it now. And Em's like, yeah, that's great. And I kind of know that I wanted you to do this, but you're pissing me off because I've gone past the point where I kind of need it in the same way.
Yeah. Where was this when I actually needed it, when our lives were in literal peril? I think the other thing about Unveiled, and without giving too much away, is that there was a very negative aspect to the relationship between Emmeline and her mother as well, in the way that her mother died. And I'm not going to say any more beyond that, but that it completely changes things. It wasn't that her mother just got hit by a car or anything like that. There was a very violent ending there, which really complicates the whole issue of their relationship. And for me, that was a really big draw for me. It was highly emotional and intricate and interesting. And I do think that, obviously the big part of that is that the story itself centers around familial relationships, so it was integral, and it was just I just really loved it.
The other mother relationship I will mention is Kieran's relationship with his mother.
That's also quite complicated.
Kieran's come from a background of, well, abuse basically his entire family, and his mother did the right thing in the end in leaving his father and taking the children with her, without going into too much detail of exactly what happened where. But I think it's left things a little bit sort of charged between them, because she sees things that have potentially affected him in how he how he acts, even though he's sort of, he's grown up and he's put a lot of things behind him. But she's worried that somehow it's made him emotionally quite stunted, and he doesn't appreciate her pecking away at him at all. And he really doesn't appreciate it when she starts interfering in his relationship with his choice of girlfriend, particularly since he doesn't really understand why she's doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is also interesting, of course, that she has three daughters.
Yeah.
And one son. And I do think that she has a very particular relationship with Kieran because he is her son.
Yeah, there's definitely... I mean, she loves all her children. She's got a slightly charged relationship with the oldest child, which is Kieran's older sister as well.
Yeah.
Which I've never really explored, and I'm not going to go into that now. But with Kieran, I think she's very invested in him not turning into his father, which, strangely enough, is Kieran being very invested in not turning into his father.
Yeah.
But because she didn't manage to protect him at a crucial point, she's kind of retroactively protecting him. And he's gone past the point where he needs that sort of protection. What he kind of needs now is support.
Yeah.
For his decisions and the things he wants to do.
Yeah. I also think that there was an element of the fact that she didn't know how to deal with him after she initially left her husband.
Yeah, I mean, there's an entire book that no one except Madeline has seen, in fairness. Which does discuss, I suddenly thought, we could start talking about this and nobody else has had the chance to read this because I haven't released it to anyone.
But oh, yeah. Okay. I have an insider perspective.
But, yeah, it gets covered a little bit in Betwixt and Between. You get flashes from her perspective. And she finally talks to Em about it. Fairly frankly, probably more frankly than Em really wants to be told by her boyfriend's mother, for example.
Yeah.
So you do see her perspective, and she is fiercely protective of her children. She's quite fearsome in general. Even Em's kind of like, okay, I'm just not going to piss her off. I'm really going to try not to.
Yes, but
this very protectiveness is the thing that leads to so much disaster in a lot of ways. And this stubborn refusal on Kieran's part to see his mother's perspective again is kind of also leads to it. And poor Em ends up being piggy in the middle between them.
Yeah. Which doesn't end well.
No, it really doesn't. But I tried to make Maeve, that's Kieran's mother, as much of a character as I possibly could. And I feel like I did succeed somewhat because she is defined to a certain extent by what happened to all of them and by her relationships with her children. But she's also a person in her own right. She's just making the choice to focus very much on this side of her life.
Yeah.
Rather than anything else. And you kind of get that feeling of, once I was kind of weak and easily led, and now I'm like, I take shit from nobody kind of thing.
Yeah.
From her, which absolutely. I appreciate.
Yeah.
And I also understand her children's perspective in the sense of not really getting where their mother's coming from in the same way.
Yeah.
And because of the age gaps with the children, they've all had a completely different perspective on where everything happened and how they react to all of it. I mean, Aoife would have been a baby, so she wouldn't remember. Soraka would have been at that formative age of sort of about 5 years old, so she remembers, but what she really remembers is the instability of it all. She doesn't remember specific events so much as not really knowing where they are and feeling quite unsafe, so anything that knocks her world makes her feel unsafe and act up. Kieran remembers very specific things, but and is kind of a bit messed up about a lot of it.
Yeah.
And Bridie, being the caretaker, has not ever really been allowed the chance to kind of process a lot of it in some ways, or she's had to process it very, very quickly and very differently from her siblings because she's never really been allowed to be a child.
Yeah.
So, again, it was an interesting dynamic to look at, and it's messed up, and they all love each other, and, again, they all don't really understand each other at all.
Yeah, and it does. I do like it, the way that it's all written. The fact that there is this, you know, this bridge that needs to be crossed between them, and they do eventually all kind of come together and start to understand each other's perspectives a little bit more. But it's nice because the trauma has affected them all very differently. Because, as you say, they were all different ages, and I like the fact that that's been explored.
Yeah, so yeah, parts of that book were really quite difficult to write, actually, looking back. But I think it sort of came off well. And it was interesting having Em as the outside perspective, in the sense of she hasn't come from the happiest family background, so she knows how messy families can get, and yet this is kind of a whole other level for her.
Yes.
It just makes me think back to Kieran piously saying in the first book, "Oh no, you shouldn't act like you shouldn't keep things about your mother from your father. He deserves to know." Kind of thing. Even when I was writing at the time, I was kind of like, "Bitch, seriously, dude, come on."
Yeah, but I do feel like that is coming from the fact that he feels internal guilt about it, really.
Yeah, definitely.
But I love the family relationships and the family dynamic.
So, what we're saying is make your family interfamilial and parent-child dynamic relationships, make them dynamic. Make them nuanced.
Dynamic does not have to mean making them bad relationships entirely. You can have sort of dynamic relationship, which is ultimately still a good, you know, parent-child relationship in terms of caregiver, but might be that there's a lack of understanding, or that there's, you know, there's issues on which they divide, you know, anything like that. I think it really adds something to it.
It's like, even with actively abusive parents, you may still have a child or a grown-up child who has some fond memories, and that kind of complicates the issue even further and screws things up even more. In this unmentionable, unpublished book that Madeline's read and no one else has, Kieran's got memories of going off fishing with his father, for example.
Yeah.
And the fact that, suddenly he was the best boy for the day kind of thing. And it's just that kind of screws things up for him in some ways even more. And yet, at the same time, he wouldn't want to lose that one indication that actually, at some point, his father did actually value him. So, these things are messy. They're not black and white. And I think there's this school of thought whereby people are just not comfortable with a grey perspective. And they're so much more interesting, and they bring so much more to the story, in my opinion.
Absolutely. I think you're right. And I also think that we've run out of time.
We have. Well, we have got through almost everything, I think. So
we have. Good job.
High five.
Virtually. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And Jules, I think you've got one for us.
Yes, I've just finished reading Queen of Nothing by Holly Black. I'm finishing a lot of trilogies in this last couple of weeks, but this is the third book in her Folk of the Air trilogy. As I said earlier, when Holly Black writes fairies, she does not write nice things. Don't think cute little glittery Tinkerbell things. This is just not what happens. The whole premise of the Folk of the Air trilogy, which starts with Cruel Prince, follows on in Wicked King, and finishes in Queen of Nothing, is that basically this a pair of twins and their older sister, their mother is killed by a fairy lord.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that the older sister is the fairy lord's daughter with their mortal mother, because she abandoned him and went off with another mortal man, and he's a red cap. But you know, it's a bad choice, really, for an initial boyfriend.
Terrible choice.
so he murders their parents in front of them, and then to satisfy honor, he said, "Well, you know, I've just taken your mother away from you, and she was my wife. Therefore, you are now all my children." So he takes them back to fairy with him, and they are raised in fairy, and they're raised in the twins, especially the fully mortal girls, are raised in a state of constant terror because they cannot protect themselves. I mean, there's all these little charms and things they can use, but they've got to be constantly on guard because they're being sent to school, for example, with peers who can make them drown themselves if they want to. They can literally glamour them to do almost anything if they let their guard down for one moment. So Jude, who is the main character, pretty much spends the first 18 years of her life in a state of constant terror and anger. And it, this trilogy is all about charting her course as she gradually learns to take power for herself. I don't need to go into any more detail than that. It's an absolute delight. The first book's a little slow, but once you get past that, it's just, it's unbelievable. They're really, really good. Highly recommend it.
Brilliant. That just sounds right up my alley.
Yeah, I think it really is, actually.
To be honest, you had me at fairies, so. And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening. Do leave us a comment telling us which are your favourite parent-child relationship depictions in sci-fi and fantasy, and whether you agree with us or disagree with us. And we'll say thanks and bye. Goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.